The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, Bill gets the fun, Dementals. John avoids the steps to Howard. Huge. Simpson talks about using AI for attacks. Doug drums on the tribal knowledge, rock my world. Hear what really happened at RSA. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th, at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
For details on anything you hear about at The Cyber Show, go to thecybershow.co.
Breaking news on The Cyber Show. The RSA show just ended, and the big news is there was no big news. Companies are using the same old stuff and saying the same old things. AI technology was all the rage, and of course, it gave the wrong answers every time we tested it. Well, I guess if you want breaking news, you shouldn't go to the RSA.
And now a word from our sponsor.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
During this segment of the show, we talk to historical figures from the cyber world. We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
We're back with Bill. And last time he was talking about, my goodness, he worked on the early days of Sabre, which is older than almost, more than half the population of the world, probably way older, to outlive everybody. But the other thing you were working on besides the administrative components was the security stuff. So talk about the security stuff.
The security was LISP-based. We identified the functions of user identification and authentication, access control and administration, alerts and alarms.
So authorization, this was what, the matrix model, right? Subject-object model, something like that?
It was user to transaction type.
Okay, so it was function.
Yep. It was to a particular function. So you might do accounts receivable and subsets of accounts receivable. You would be able to do transactions. You'd be able to run creditworthiness.
Yeah, so you could do gap separation, right? Generally accepted accounting principle separation of duties.
Okay. Oh yes, and we did.
But it was controlling the application, and the data was not being controlled. Rather, the application would be able to access the data it was able to access by its design and implementation, right?
Right. And this was an application-only machine or system. There was no development being done in this system. So,
well, any production environment should be separating R&D from change control from production, which used to be the model, right? Yeah. That still should be the model, but, you know.
It should be the model, but it isn't. And what happened was that as the scale in the early days, the efficiency of computers went up with scale. The bigger the system, the less each item of computing was going to cost you. At some point or another, the scale shifted the other way, and we went from everybody wanting the biggest computer possible to everybody wanting small computers.
And yeah, as many, the right number of small ones, you can scale it, right?
Right.
And, yeah, except for the shared access to data sets.
Ah, yes. Oh, well.
I know the pain point. You know.
therein lies history, right? So we went from having really, really tight control. We had the Orange Book.
Wait a minute. When you say tight control, you're talking about tight control of users' access to applications and then applications well-controlled in terms of what they could actually do with content.
Yes. And
But that all changed. So what was the change that happened?
In the general purpose shared computing model, the time-sharing model in those days, we had the Orange Book.
You know, the Orange Book was way later, right? That was the 1980s, right?
No. The development of the Orange Book started in the 70s, in the early 70s.
Yeah, but it wasn't approved until 84, right?
Well, but we had the principles, and those principles still apply, but we don't use them. For example, we had the rule of least possible privilege, which we need desperately today. In fact, what we call that today is we call that zero trust.
Well, we call it one little part of zero trust, but still not implementable because granularity issues. But if you want to get into the zero trust discussion with me, then we're going to be here for an extra few hours.
Right. Okay.
but let's least privilege. But then simplicity principle was in the generally accepted system security principles and got removed.
Well, it became inconvenient. And the history of security is that convenience trumps security almost every time, at least half the time. And so if you look at the average edge computer today, the access control rule default is read-write.
Yeah, everything can be done by anybody.
Everything can be done by everybody. And we would contend that, or I would contend that, for most objects, they should either be execute-only or read-only.
Right.
The ability to write should be tightly restricted.
The separation between content that comes with the system and content associated with the user is that fundamental separation, right? The user should be owner and control of their own content, and nobody else should be. And the system should be the content that is the property of the system and not of the user, right?
Well, and as I talk to you, I am talking to you on my iPad where I cannot do anything from the user interface that makes a persistent change to the underlying programming, either of the application or of the operating system. Now, if I come at it from the network, maybe I can, but not from the user interface. And we have a rigorous separation between the development of an application and the use of the application. So we are moving in a constructive direction. and I always remember a presentation that you made to IBM Research in Hawthorne, in which you proposed that in a world of application-only computers, we would enjoy most, but not all, of the benefits of the general-purpose computer.
And safety from things like computer viruses, because the lack of general-purpose function. Virus.
Right.
Except for the recursive functionality, right? Because you're going to give me a spreadsheet that I can use to write programs. Okay, so now we start to hear fundamental concepts that have been around forever.
Not forever, though. But as I listen to that, you know, it's reminding me of calls that I had today, you know, this week, you know, this year, this month, right? You know, and we're in supply chain security. There's a group of people that numbers in the tens, you know, a couple hundred, perhaps, you know, these days. And we're having these same sort of conversations. And you had mentioned, you know, that the complexity rule was dropped, you know, and the same sort of thing. A group of people, really smart, debating a bunch of complex issues, picking what will be in, you know, recommendations and guidance that will themselves inflect for decades. Who was right in that room? Were the people arguing to keep the complexity rule or get rid of it right? I don't know the answer to that.
Right. But the thing that's fascinating about listening to Bill is, you know, this is not a new discussion.
Right.
You know, this is like a 60-year-old discussion, and it's been had again and again. And people just don't bother to read the literature, which is a problem in our, you know, education system around cybersecurity. And it's so much more in the art than in the engineering discipline or the science or anything like that. And it shows an immaturity of a field.
And, I agree with the last part 1,000%, right? You know, that's, as you know, we're only halfway through figuring out how this works. It is so important to understand, right? You know, that we see standards and rules and, you know, way things are done around us all the time. And maybe they're right. Maybe they're fine. But because something's been discussed for 5 years or 70 years or 700 years, doesn't mean that, you know, you go all the way back, there's five people in the room. And the four things or the seven things in the list that we all know and we take as writ were the shortest list of a larger list that all those five people were thinking, you know, among them, three of them thought this or two of them thought that, and they never made it to the cut. So we were yet to figure out anything. You know, that's maybe we're doing it wrong. Maybe, you know, the list that came out should have, like that one complexity rule. Maybe it should have been there. Maybe it shouldn't. Good question.
Okay. But listen to what Bill said. Bill is brilliant, right?
No
doubt. What Bill said is convenience trumps security every time, almost every
time. I know.
And so that's what it is. The simplicity principle has to do with good, sound security practices, but it's inconvenient to try to figure things out and simplify them and get to true understanding before you go do something. So people just sort of throw stuff together. They mash it up and add stuff. And what we have is, you know, I describe this as, you know, crap built on crap, but yet the world continues to
function,
you know, not just function better than it did.
Right. Exactly.
So at what point does the Tower of Babel collapse? And maybe the answer is never.
Maybe it doesn't. That's right. You know, and it's
so I had this other theory that I brought up. It's I guess we could call it a critical race theory, but it's nothing to do with that critical race theory. It's about the race between attackers and implementers. And basically one of the solutions is run faster. Just keep building and building and changing things, and the attackers, you know, they can't catch up because by the time it took them, you know, 3 days to figure out how to break into it, it all changed. That also means that because it's changing all the time, it becomes sort of insane to use. But, you know, that's the life we're living, right?
Well, right. You know, me in these boats, right? You know, the 7 mile bridge storm, you know, where I was anchored with very little power in the middle of the night, watching a storm form and hit me from Cuba. It's all, you know, could I have better vessels? Oh, yes. Right. Well, you know, however, you know, it's a matter of time. You know, I have 3 hours and 6 hours in these windows. And if I can make those windows of time pass and still be there, they're fine. And that's the opposite side of the simplicity complexity argument, that good enough. Yeah. By the time, you know, safes are rated in hours. How long will it take me to break it? If I can make a safe strong enough to keep you out until the sun rises, then it's long enough.
Well, until the detection triggers the response force.
Right.
Yeah. So all of that makes perfect sense. And yet there's another question. So I wrote code, you know, long ago that still works. Sabre, the code was written long ago and it still works. Oh, yes, it's been updated over time, but it's not been rewritten.
Right.
It still works. And so the thoughtful approach where you figure something out and take the time to, you know, get it to where it does the right thing the right way, and you fix all those problems, that can last a very long time. Basically until the infrastructure below it gets taken out from under it. And this has to do with backward compatibility in programs. So I've had software that I had to update, I guess is the right word, every 15 or 20 years because some of the underlying infrastructure no longer works the way it used to. So I have to change a couple of the steps in the program so that they now work with the new way of calling things. But other than that, they're unchanged. And so a big part of this is the time to market drives rapid creation of a technology, which is, you know, haphazard at best. And almost nobody ever goes back and redoes it. It just is what it is. And then it dies off. So there are these things that last a long time and have permanence. And then there are these things that are sort of more ephemeral and come and go quickly. And I just think that that's an interesting set of worlds. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of stuff in the middle.
Right. That's true, right? I mean, you know, because the value of doing something quickly and have it work and then just leave it the heck alone is very high. And the value when it's really serious of going all the way in engineering from the ground up is very high. I guess there's not a lot of evolutionary drivers to go to the middle.
What comes to mind is the Fortran libraries for minimizing the effect of errors. Right? Error propagation is a big problem. And so if you only have so many digits and errors propagate, it doesn't take many calculations before the errors grow to the point where the answers are so bad you can't use them anymore. In fact, they might come out as the opposite answer in a decision. So these routines were written god-awful long ago for Fortran libraries, and they've been adopted year after year after year, and they still work. And anybody that goes and does something that doesn't meet those libraries ends up with this error explosion problem. And, you know, so they go back to the mathematician, you know, who figured this out and wrote Fortran code. So those sorts of things have permanence because they figured it out and did it right, and it turns out to be important.
Right.
And evolution tries to evolve out of them and then fails, right? So you get the failure of attempts to do it a different way, and then they go back and say, why should I go and figure this out all again? I'll just go back and use the thing that works. So I just think it's fascinating in the sort of the cyber world where we talk about everything is new and changing all the time and it's all blah, 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 blah. And then, you know, oh no, somebody in the 1940s did some equations, in the 1950s implemented, in the 1960s it became the standard and hasn't changed since. And nobody alive even remembers at some point the time at which it was created, but we all still use that. How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions, and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields. Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
John, welcome back. So last time we were talking, you were carrying around guns and bags of money. So what happened after that?
Well, I quickly established that our future as a potential man and wife probably wasn't going to set well with me being a PI in Los Angeles. So I started assessing where I might go, and I ended up going to work for the Hughes Company, Hughes Aircraft Company specifically. And my first assignment was to support a Howard Hughes project. There was a huge storage building on Romaine Street out in Burbank. And this is where Howard kept all of his major holdings, if you will, his records and so forth. So during that project, I was able to see things like the original bill of sale for TWA to Hughes that was written on paper towels from the Statler Hitlin Hotel.
There you go.
Yeah, and other very... I read a proposal that he submitted once to buy the AEC, Atomic Energy Commission.
Okay, so he was going to buy the Atomic Energy Commission from the federal government.
Well, he wanted them out of Nevada.
It would not go through.
Okay, he wanted them out of Nevada. Well, that obviously that proposal was turned down. So it was a glimpse into a history that very few people ever got to see. And of course,
what's the strangest thing? Because these obviously were strange. What was the strangest thing you saw there ever?
Well, to me, those were a couple of strange things. But his, I really learned that he owned a large part of Nevada, basically. And there was some question as to whether he was actually a larger landowner in Nevada than Nevada was. And he had gold mines. He had cattle ranches. He had, in those days, and now we're talking late 60s, early 70s, in those days, there wasn't an empty lot on the strip. And for about a quarter mile off of the strip, any open land he owned.
Hmm.
And
did you ever meet him? He was famously reclusive.
No. And although I wanted to, obviously, anyone would, unless you work for him. If I met a lot of the now famous executives that supposedly ruined his life and helped him, and said Walter Mayhew, who was a deputy director of the FBI when he retired, went to work for Hughes. And so, and I don't recall anyone ever suggesting that I should try and get an appointment with Howard.
They were all, no, you don't want to talk to him.
Yeah. Well, and the story goes, at least the rumors were, that there were lots of people who were, you know, basically on the top of the escalator when they went into the meeting, and were in the dungeon when they left, and there was no escalator.
All right, so it was one of those things where the meeting was like the last thing in your career for our use.
So does that sound like a lot of bosses that you've experienced? You do not want to meet them?
No, not at all, actually. It's interesting to think about Howard Hughes. I mean, Howard Hughes was an issue, you know, nationally, right? You know, can a single individual have that much power? You know, all the upsides, you know, of open markets and so on and so forth, great innovation and moving markets fast, but they end up with a person who is perhaps more powerful than everyone else put together, right? And that was, you know, Hughes had 0.15% of GDP was his wealth. And now we have, you know, individuals today with 1.5% of GDP personally. Right? He makes interesting trust dynamics, you know, that, again, just arbitrarily as security people, you try to think of how you put that together.
Right, the aggregation of risk. But it's not just what he owned, right? It's the consequence associated with what he did. Right,
the gravitational field, yes.
The military contracts, the national security implications, and he's hiring, as of course we know, people from the high levels of government. They leave government to come and work for him, right? So they're leaving the center of power in government where you're under all these controls and restrictions, and you have all this knowledge of what's going on the inside and all these contacts, and now you come and work for Howard Hughes. And then this notion that you're up on the top of the escalator. I assume he means you're just about, you know, as high as you can get in the corporation. And then you're like working in a broom closet because you talk to the guy. So,
right. Taken by itself, right. It's a good example of how, you know, a pure anything doesn't work. Right. And this is the kind of thing that building cyber systems, building boats, you know, building security systems, you know, point out over and over again, right? You know, there is, you know, you may believe passionately in X, Y, Z, but take that to its extreme, and it's really hard to build reliable, stable systems, right? You know, everything's got to be a combination.
Yeah, all right. But now then, let's talk about the strange stuff he found in the building. And he only told us two examples, right? The contract to buy TWA handwritten on paper towels from a hotel. That's how we did business then, right? It wasn't.
Oh yeah, planned to buy the Atomic Energy Commission, right?
Yeah, didn't go through.
Right. You know, Neal Stephenson's snow crash, you know, was sort of dystopian, you know, midterm near future, where you know, an individual buys a U.S. aircraft carrier, right? You know,
that's
nothing compared to the AEC, right? The AEC, sure. The Atomic Energy Commission essentially owned the national labs and all of the nuclear weapons complex.
Right. But you know, again, my example is that, you know, that is a cartoonish sort of thing in this 20-year-old novel. But again, you know, we have individuals now who are perfectly capable of buying U.S. aircraft carrier fleets. You know, what does that mean? You know, that kind of economic power in individual, as you say, unregulated hands.
Let's talk about what it means, because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely is the old saying. And if you look at the incredibly wealthy and powerful people of the world, a lot of them, Howard Hughes, you know, went wacko, I guess. And if you look at some of the ones today, and when you get up into that $1 trillion range, these people also go wacko. And you see that in their behaviors, right? They start to buy into this notion that they're somehow godlike, and then they do insanely crazy things, stupid things. They take advantage of other people and get found out. And remember back, you know, in that time frame, we're talking about, you know, JFK, when he was president, you know, had, you know, this apparently this affair with Marilyn Monroe that nobody in the press told anybody about, but they all knew it. And today, you know, if you find out anything about a president, well, today is not right. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, any scandal like that would be completely, utterly destructive. And then the Trump era comes along and, you know, that's completely normalized, right? And then, you know, we're not going to talk politics, but I guess the point is this thing about power and powerful people and what happens to them when you go too far up that stack is what he was experiencing in, you know, before he got out of the zone of normalcy with Howard Hughes.
Well, you know, this is the cyber show. Let's think, you know, think about it in terms of information systems, right? You know, and yeah, that old cliche, true enough, you know, ultimate power corrupts ultimately. We start breaking down, why is that? Right. And it's because a lot of the, you know, decision processes, you know, I don't think it's politics to talk about Putin as such these days. You know, Vladimir Putin has got himself in a walled, you know, little cocoon where information flow to him, his use of information, processing it for nation state purposes is not optimal. Right.
And well, and this is what happened to Stalin, right? Stalin did the same thing, right? Once you get to the point where you can't trust anybody around you and you have to kill the people that were your allies, it all decays. And you know, I've read a lot of the history about, you know, what is it, sort of the worst strategic errors of all time, right? Strategic intelligence failures, I think, is the name of the book on this. And, you know, you look at what happened to all of these super powerful people that brought them down. And almost always it's they create a bubble. They don't get good information. They start making bad decisions. They start, you know, quite literally killing the people around them. And, you know, it all falls apart. They get,
right.
You know,
and you know, look, I'm a libertarianish Yankee kind of person. I love, you know, independently having the liberty to do my own thing and, you know, literally, you know, build boats on the water because I bloody well feel like it and whatnot. So I get it, right? You know, however, right, history shows over and over again, you know, businesses show over and over again, you know, simply information systems, you know, networks, you know, large networks. We could do a whole series of shows just picking up stories where the problem was that one person was in charge. Right. One person just had the authority to say, you know what? I'm just doing it this way. And it all crashes. You go, why was that? It's because big stable things are complicated.
But even in ancient times, when you had a successful, you know, dictator, king, whatever, their children, eventually you get to a child who's just not up to it. And then it all falls over.
And now a word from our sponsor.
Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. Go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th, at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
We're going to be talking to Dave Bailey for a few weeks about the RSA show that was last week. I've worked with Dave for many years. He's a sales and marketing and cybersecurity. So here we go. So Dave, you are still recovering, I take it, from the RSA show, right?
It was pretty brutal, I must admit. But yes, I'm recovering. But yeah, quite worthwhile. I think it was a great show.
We got a lot of interesting stuff that you find out when you go to a big show like this. And what I wanted to do is just, you know, for the folks out on the radio, give them a sense of what it's about. You've been to a lot of these shows. What is it like to go walking around that floor for however many hours?
It's always interesting because every year you see you know, a lot of fresh faces and new vendors. And there was certainly no shortage of kind of shiny new vendors this year at the show. You know, also, I saw kind of a recurring theme. A lot of the folks there somehow are trying to figure out a way to interpose the term AI into their marketing pitches. So we saw quite a bit of that. I saw quite a bit of zero trust being pitched as well. Quite a lot of discussions around passwords and passwords going away and those types of things. So it was an interesting mix. And there was quite a few foreign vendors there. I was actually surprised how many different foreign countries were represented this year. It seemed like there was a bigger grouping than there has been in previous years.
This show is brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.
We're talking with Simpson here, who has a long career, both as a cybersecurity, we'll call it threat actor for the moment, and as a journalist.
Let's move up to today. So what do you do today? And, you know, what's the newest, fascinating, most interesting thing you're working on now?
Well, after NPS, I was at NIST, and after NIST, I was at Census, and after Census, I was at DHS, and I was recruited by a philanthropic organization in New York to leave DHS and work on a philanthropic project involving beneficial AI. And so right now, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about AI and what the positive and the negative things are. And I'm especially interested in how AI and cybersecurity interact with each other and how AI and privacy interact with each other.
So, you know, obviously about, you know, the GPT latest release and so forth. And I have a saying that says, artificial intelligence, aye. So one of the challenges with the most recent technologies out there is they have these conversations that seem to do better than about 50 or 60% of the normal population you run into, but they clearly are not intelligent. And the question is, does that say something about the AI or does that say something about the people?
So you're referring specifically to the large language model AIs that have been publicly released, like BERT and ChatGPT. If you read the text that these systems generate, they are bullshit artists. It's not just that they don't understand what they're saying. It's that there's nothing deep in what they are saying. There's a lot of word salad, but it comes across as okay. It's like a lot of nice introductory and conclusion paragraphs, but there's no real meat to what they're saying.
Well, so they're very good at summarizing. Now, they don't necessarily understand any of it, of course. Clearly, they don't understand it, but they can pull out key portions of sentences and assemble them into bulleted lists.
Well, they will summarize, but their summarizations can be self-contradictory.
Well, yes. No, consistency is, what is it? Consistency is the hobgoblin of, you know, small minds, whatever it is.
Small minds, yes.
Yes, well, okay. So they have an advantage over us, right? The big advantage is they're much better read than any human being can ever be. They have read more stuff. The problem is they haven't understood it, but it doesn't matter because all they're really doing is assembling piece parts together in what looks like other things that other people have written. And so it seems to make sense. So
their first advantage is, in fact, that they are better read. And their second advantage is that they don't care if what they're doing is incredibly boring.
Oh, well, that I don't think is necessarily an advantage, but I'll say my view of their second advantage is they can properly write sentences with capitalization, spelling, appropriate use of syntax. And that then, you know, beats about another 75% of the human population they're competing against. And then the other thing is they have some interesting sort of pre-structured ways of doing things, right? So they'll make a statement, then they'll give an example, then they'll draw a concluding sentence. And that's how they write a paragraph, which as a structure works. It's more convincing, even though, of course, it doesn't make any sense.
So I'm less interested in the large language model AIs. I understand they've grabbed a lot of attention right now.
That's because they do better than the average computer security consultant, both in terms of answering questions, but also in terms of getting actual right answers. Because I find most computer security consultants get wrong answers at a higher rate than the AI.
So back in the 80s, one of my classmates at MIT was this genius named Bob Baldwin. And unfortunately, he died of brain cancer a few years ago. But Bob's PhD thesis was an expert system, old-style AI, that did privilege escalation and penetrations of Unix systems. And it was called Clang. And I'm interested in sort of that kind of AI. How can we have AI that do really good jobs at cyber attack? How can we do AI that do really good jobs at graph exploration for the purpose of manipulation and penetration?
So yeah, now I tend to call this automated analysis, right? So when you say AI, that's the misnomer that's been carried through, and there've been, you know, lots of names, expert systems and you know, deep thought and you name it, you know, neural networks, you know, they're all technologies as part of that. But at the end of the day, it's about automation. Automation that does better than alternatives for particular situations.
Well, you could say the same thing about human beings, right? So,
when you say we're automation, so I'll distinguish the artifact from the biologically derived artifact.
That's fine. That's fine. We're automation for spreading the genes, and anything else is gravy. From a personnel security point of view, the language models paired with a lot of other automation to make millions of people think that they're corresponding with millions of other people when, in fact, they're all corresponding with the machine. And the purpose of that machine is to systematically extract information and do open source intelligence. And
solve the puzzle problem, right?
Yeah. So I'm concerned about that. That's on the social side.
Well, but if you look at these, you know, even these language models, because they're hoovering up all this stuff, if you just start to ask them particular questions, you can actually generate what you would think of as classified or confidential information by just asking them have those questions and having them give you the range of answers. And it's not just that. There's also the amplification associated with influence operations. So it's, right. Yeah. So once you start to use these machines, you can get much better at influencing people than, for example, the current spam, which is just ridiculously poorly done compared to what a nice automated system for generating paragraphs can do.
So right now, spam is easy to distinguish from personalized messages. And right now, mass mailed messages that are not personalized are easy to distinguish.
And yet successful.
But we can imagine very detailed personalized messages that also use the feedback of AI approaches to do much better attacks than our current state of the art.
And let's talk about defenses against them.
I'm having a hard time there.
Okay, so I can think of ways to attack, but defenses. I don't know about that.
Well, let's talk about the bulk of that, right? You know, artificial intelligence is neither artificial nor intelligent. You know, it is exactly what it is, and what you guys are talking about, you know, the AIs out there are better read than anybody else. They don't know what any of it means. They don't have the capability of knowing. You know, the understanding part is not there, right? And it's a whole different technological and metaphysical discussion on when and if we can create a sentient being from whole cloth. But this ain't it.
Or whether we should.
But again, totally separate conversation. Everybody's talking about this. And I really think, you know, words matter. You know, saying artificial intelligence over and over and over again changes the way we think about this. If we said machine learning or large language models or whatnot, we would think about it differently and we'd behave differently. You know, the words we use program our actions.
A marketing function of the use of AI and artificial intelligence, and it's not recent. It's been here for at least 70 years. It's been marketed this way.
I understand. But you know, so if I use these bloody, you know, I have to use it because otherwise people won't know what I'm talking about. So anyways, you know, you look back and you won't, but I said it. So what I'm looking forward to with AI, it'll take our boat effort, right? And I think I've used the term AI captain a lot, but I really mean AI host, right? And that's the human thing that consumes a lot of tasks that I see analogous to the things that I can do in my cyber work, like putting together a press release. Can you just put it together? I've done it a million times. I know basically what it looks like. I don't want it to be right. You're an intern. Just put it in paragraphs, put it in order. I'll go back and fix it. saved me a lot of time. I really don't feel like writing another one from scratch again.
So this has to do with what I was talking about in a previous discussion. People are overloaded, and the use of computers and the expectation of performance has just created much more overload on the cognitive capacity of people, but also the mechanical ability to just do everything you have to do to get all this crap done. So the automation that makes us more efficient, I view as a great benefit. And that's really what you're saying. And that's what I view the value of AI is. And you're right. You know, writing a press release, it's better at writing a press release than I am.
And you're there. You can edit it.
Yeah.
But it will have about the right number of paragraphs and sentences anyways, which would take you 15 minutes. Why bother?
That's right. I completely agree. But I do have to review it. But I have to review it if I have an intern do it, and they're more expensive.
Well, and I haven't started doing this, but I plan to, right? I'm thinking through both, you know, taking the time to learn how to and so forth. Easy enough. But for a lot of things, I would really rather just start with a template. And if an AI, ChatGPT or whatever, can just make me a 7-paragraph template on the topic, then I'm still going to spend maybe the same amount of time editing it that I would have spent writing it. But normally, by the time I'm done writing it, I'm done, right? You know, but you know, doubling that time is not on the table. So I like writing. I want to inflect things my way. I don't expect an intern or a large language model to know how I would say it. But I'd like to start with a framework. And I'll go on and jank around with it and make it my work.
If we can get to 80, 90% with relatively simple automation without spending $10 billion to build the large language model, and it can run on my little computer, then it's probably worth doing. But if it's going to take that tens of billions of dollars to get another percent out of it, it's not worth it to me. And it's the same for the speed of life.
Right. What AI is for, as I think about these electric boats we're building, you know, I think about, I've used this term AI captain. Right. But it's not really that. And that's the wrong use for AI in that purpose. It's an AI host. You know, it's taking these human process things of who are you? Nice to meet you. You're a family of four. Right. When are you showing up? What are your requirements? Here you are. You're here on board of this boat, operating the vessel itself, taking care of them, taking care of all those tasks that I know I could put somebody on, but to be handled mechanically.
So so this word AI, I like the word automation. It's not artificial intelligence. It's just automation. I know. Right. And for the most part, that's what we want. We really just want automation so that it's good if the automation is sophisticated in the sense that it doesn't do stupid things. It's good if the automation is not too sophisticated. So if we want to do stupid things, we can because, you know, that's how I am. I really don't want my car to prevent me from changing lanes when I want to because it thinks I should be going slower.
Look, I think I ranted on our last segment, you know, on how I disagree with both words in artificial intelligence, but I also disagree with the E in SIEM, right? You know, and for 20 years, I haven't won that battle. So I use the term AI because people recognize it.
Yeah, but tell them what SIEM or SEIM is.
Security Information and Event Management, right? So the SIM tool, pronounced SIM, SIM tools are the AWACS out there looking over your network, soaking up data, letting you see what's going on. The problem was that an analyst in one of the big analyst firms got caught in the argument with logging security event management SEM and security information management SIM and decided to mix them two. The problem with this is, as I've tried to explain to the person involved and everybody else, is it's like saying the automotive and carburetor industry, right? You know, an event is a piece of information. Why do we single it out? Why do we single out carburetors? Isn't that going to change the entire automotive industry because we're all thinking carburetors?
Okay, so we're here at the RSA still, and we're here with Tom Mullen of Hunters. Their tagline, which I'm not a big fan of, is move beyond SIEM, which is Security Incident and Event Management. The question I asked him, and he's going to answer it in a second, is, are you sure? Why is it SIEM versus SEIM? And that's historically been a question. For the last 20 years, I've been asking people, and nobody's given me a good answer. And now we have the answer.
Well, Fred, I'm going to keep it simple. And let's just step back from security for a second, and I'll take you back to English class. It's SIEM because it's I before E, except after C.
Sim. Okay, and that is the winning answer for the last 20-plus years on why it should be SIEM versus SEIM. Congratulations, Hunters. Awesome job. We'll see you on the radio on the Cyber Show.
Well, you know, this is the Cyber Show, so I'll throw out some red meat to the technical geeks driving in the Silicon Valley traffic listening to this, right? So right now in the world, the software bill of material, the SBOM conversation,
is just starting to wrap his head around the fact that there's not one. You know, there's a software bill of material that was, you build your code, you produce an SBOM, you make that available to somebody, that's great. But I take that code in a device and I put it in the field and I'm running it. So there's a runtime SBOM of what exactly is actually running on that device, which may or may not be different than what it was on the way to the build. And to your point, you know, an event occurs around that individual device in its total context, not just, you know, a log file, but everything it's up to and what it's doing and how it feels.
Right. The chocolate factory exploded. That's an event, right? Correct. Including all the response and everything. That's the event that we're talking about. Now, what was the, what's the information? Well, you know, we have some of it and then it exploded. So we don't quite have the rest.
Tuesday, May 9th at 9 a.m. go to Angel. Present your company and get on the show. Tuesday, May 9th at 1 p.m., join the All.net members forum to discuss cybersecurity issues. For more details and to sign up, go to thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena.
Okay, so we're around the turn of the century, and at this point, somewhere you transition into a career as an analyst, consultant, whatever it is, and this is really where I met you.
Yes, correct.
Start talking.
All right. Well, again, I think, you know, I want to credit you, to be honest with you. I remember we were sitting in a conference room in the early days. I think it was maybe 2005. Where you were sharing with us and the team of Burton Group at the time, your thoughts on cybersecurity, which were very important.
So it was actually much, much earlier than that. So I started working at Burton Group in 2001.
Okay. Maybe it was then. I'm sorry.
Maybe it was 2002. Yeah. It was April Fool's. I remember I started on April Fool's Day.
Yep.
So, which is probably appropriate for me as an analyst, but you were there already. So talk about where you started with Burton Group, what you did there through that course of your career.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to a couple of things I said earlier. I got very fluent on the technical to business kind of architecture, strategy, data flows, et cetera. But I credit you largely with opening my eyes to the phrase risk management. And again, in the early 2000s now we're talking, this was not something the boards of directors or CXOs talked as much about from a cyber standpoint as you brought to light. At that point in time, I was able to take a lot of what you shared with me and the team. And how should I say this? I don't want to say parrot it back because that sounds like I'm being mindless, but I was able to internalize what you were teaching us about risk management and cyber security, all the things I talked about, authentication, authorization, data flows, encryption, et cetera, and wrap that around a discussion that I could take with our sales team to a level higher in the organization, typically boards of directors and CEOs, CIOs, and talk about risk management. Because the fundamental challenges that all of our customers had was how much is good enough because it's really expensive to make it perfect, right?
And it's to make it perfect, but the closer you try to get, the more expensive it gets for every step. It's like
I don't even think there is a perfect
speed of light, right? Closer you get, the harder it is to accelerate. So at that time, you were running the consulting practice in security and risk management strategies for Burton Group. Were you also running the identity management consulting group?
Yes.
Okay. So explain to people what this is, right? So Burton Group was a research and advisory firm, and you're on the consulting side. Explain what that is and how it works and the sorts of things that you did.
Yeah. I mean, basically, my whole life was charged and still is to this day. So I think it's important to note around, I'll call assessments and strategy. They would want me and or my team to come in and take a look at their security, cyber. Whenever I say security, I mean cybersecurity, not necessarily. Though I did do some physical security gigs, but cybersecurity and identity management, do an assessment of what they're doing, what tools they're using, how much risk they are able to manage to, and give them a set of recommendations for improvement. Or as part of the assessment, if they're already doing really darn good, tell them that, you know what I mean? I don't want to say it was A+. You don't need me anymore. I wasn't going in there to just try to sell to sell. But by the same token, I don't think there was any organization we went into that didn't need some help somewhere to make it better.
Right. You can never be perfect, but you can always be better. And that's true for everybody, everywhere, always.
My
regardless of cyber.
My good friend and colleague, Kevin Campman, at that time and still today, gave me the phrase that I kind of set the tone for, is like progress, not perfection. Right. And because perfection was largely unattainable. And I don't think we even had customers that were worried so much about that.
I don't think you can even tell what it is. Nobody knows what perfect would be. But there's another phrase that I learned from you, which was crawl, walk, run.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So this is sort of fundamental to the consulting practice, you know, where smart people are trying to help other smart people do their job better because you have some specialized niche knowledge that they don't have.
Right.
And they have all the detailed knowledge of what they're doing within their company.
We call that tribal knowledge.
There you go. And you need to fuse those together to improve the situation.
Yes.
That then becomes becoming a member of the tribes, right?
Yes. So let me just say this. Hardly ever did I we'd almost always go into an engagement like on a 6-week schedule and end up staying there 6 years. Not because we were milking it, not because of anything, but because of exactly what you said. It didn't take long for them to realize that their tribal knowledge needed to have a bridge to the technical world that was out there beyond what they already knew. And to have us as adjunct members of their team for longer periods of time would allow them to cross that chasm. Does that make sense?
It makes a great deal of sense. Mm-hmm. The other side of that is you're now a member of many tribes.
Yes.
And one of the fascinating things about being a member of many tribes, and one of the things about being an analyst and in the research and advisory space, is that you're not spending all your time in the context of one of these companies and getting the groupthink, and you're not getting the not invented here think. You're seeing this bigger spectrum, which makes you more knowledgeable than they are. And at the same time, you know, the people inside that organization are changing. So as you engage those people, you need to engage more and more of that population, or else the people you know disappear from the organization and then you're gone and the organization loses a capability it didn't even really know it had.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a couple things there. It's like, I can't tell you how many times the colleagues I was working with in the tribes would tell me, you say that to the CEO, because if I say it, he won't believe me. But if you say it, he'll believe it. And it's like, okay, cool. Fair enough.
Yeah. Or the other version of it, if I say it, I'll get fired. And if you say it, you won't work here anymore and I'll still have a job.
Exactly. Yeah. But I also want to say too that, and I'm a big proponent of research too, working for Burton Group. We went to Gartner. We were acquired by Gartner. I worked for Gartner for almost 6 years. Having research and consulting is really cool. I think valuable because, you know, when you go into an organization and you help them make progress and you help them, you know, see beyond their own groupthink and all that, if you can also continue to feed them research, even after your engagement is done, you can, they just transcend. They have, you know, a broader vision. They're better off for it. And I know it sounds self-serving. Oh, you're selling them research. But you're able to keep, how should I say, the fire well-stoked that you got started in there for them to, a road of constant improvement. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. In fact, it's a little bit more than that. You think notionally about the Renaissance person, right? Mm-hmm. The person that has knowledge across a huge space. And when you're working in the context of a company, you don't get that exposure. You can try to go to conferences, but you just don't get that exposure. No. And the people that are working across many of these companies and involved with the research people, they're getting much broader exposure and getting the advantage of the drill down that the people in each company are getting.
That is correct.
Yep. So you sort of become the connection for them to become the Renaissance people. And one of the things I've seen for long-term customers is they are extremely knowledgeable in a much broader spectrum of things. And it's wonderful to see because you can engage them in a complex conversation that crosses many domains And you've known them for a period of time. So there's a level of trust. So they're not worried about not telling you something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredibly beneficial. You get new ideas percolating through them that maybe change the course of their lives and change the course of the companies they work for.
Now, and changes the course of my own.
Of course. Yeah. I just love this description of consulting. I've been a consultant in one form or another, an analyst, an advisor, you name it, throughout the vast majority of my career. And when you go into places, people always talk about consulting as if it's somebody who's ripping you off. At one place, they said, so you're a consultant. That means you're going to listen to everything we say and say it back and get paid a whole lot more than we get paid, right?
Right, sure.
To which I responded, well, I certainly hope that I accurately reflect what you told me in my report, but that's not really the value I bring. And Doug does a pretty darn good job of describing, you know, a lot of this sort of knowledge that he gains and brings to bear and brings across entities.
Right. You know, it's a collaborative effort, right? And you know, in the consulting world, you know, you're an external voice, right? You know, everybody, you know, doing their job is busy doing their thing. And sometimes consultants, yes, may say the same things back to you, but they're actually paying attention to that part. Where everybody there isn't really paying attention to that part. They're paying attention to their individual pieces that have one of those parts, part of that, you know, that section in it. You know, what strikes me, though, of course, as always, is the evolution of this over time. You know, 20-something years ago, risk management was a new term, which, you know, you look at it today and say, everybody's been, no, they haven't.
Well, it's crazy to me that it was a new term then, right?
Right.
Because I didn't think it was a new term then. Certainly, people have been talking about it, certainly for my lifetime. But part of the challenge is this tribal knowledge, so to speak, doesn't get passed on in the cyber arena. Everything is like, if it didn't happen in the last 5 years, it doesn't exist. And nobody reads these history books. Nobody does the background of the studying necessary to understand the field.
It comes up so often, right? You know, the Dunning-Kruger, you know, effect, right? You know, the less you know, the more confident you are, the more you know, the less confident you are. It's become very popular in the disinformation age. You know, most people are familiar with that. I think there's a related or sort of maybe inverse thing. The more you know about something, the more you assume everybody else does, right? And I think that as we continue to go through eras of transformable change, maybe forever for the in indefinite future, that's an art itself that I think needs to get plugged in. You know, this is going to take a long time for everyone to understand it. Risk, you know, risk management. Like you, like Doug, like sort of all of us, you know, I'm not so much surprised anymore, but you know, it's, oh, okay, you're a CIO and I have to explain what risk management is to you or whatever, right? These basic concepts. Because it takes a long time. It just does. People are busy.
That's a very interesting point, right? Because when you look at, you know, several things in my career that I've come up with took 20 years to get to the point where they were sufficiently popular. And one of the problems with the patent system is that you only get a patent for 20 years. And I've had several cases where patents have expired and then they became very popular. You know, people talk about how things are happening so quickly, right? They say, oh my goodness, you know, the cell phone caught on enormously, right? And the web caught on. Yeah, I understand. The web was in the 1990s, mid to semi-late 1990s. The web was out there and becoming more popular. And now it's, you know, 2023. And now, oh, obviously the web. Boy, that caught on very quickly. And you take things like, you know, Facebook, which is not a young company anymore, right? It's been around for quite a while. And yes, it got enormous and vast. And Microsoft took a long time. Everything seems to actually take that long time. For those of us, you know, that were young once and are running out of time, it's a little bit disconcerting that everything I think of now is just not going to catch on until I'm too old to benefit from it. Interesting statistic from the Social Security says that 30% of Americans are now living past 90.
Yep.
So, you know, that's, you know, however many years that is for me, maybe, you know, 30% of Americans will be living past 100 and it'll catch on.
I've, like I said, for most of my life, I've decided don't count on that. You know, life is life. Second point is that 500 years is still finite. You know, now we're 490 years going, oh my God, I only got 10 years left. And we live linear lives, right? You know, living forever doesn't actually solve the immortality problem, right? Just means we get more of it. And I'm all for that. But I think there's people walking the earth today who live to be 1,000, and maybe they were born, one person who's born today makes it. Maybe it's somebody who's 20. I don't know.
Let's get to the important part.
the 2,000-year-old man, which is a comedy routine. Okay, so you know that routine, don't you?
Mel Brooks? What is that? That rings a bell.
I think that it's Sid Caesar, I think it was.
Okay, yeah.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill goes into the global Big Five CPA firm consulting business. John goes without Christmas presents because he has presence of mind. Simpson talks AI for defense. Doug talks about ethics and exploitation. Dave discusses breakthroughs in marketing technologies, more fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. See you next week on The Cyber Show.
A good time and foul. A good time and foul. A string beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and foul.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.